Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to a new episode of New Books Network. We're at the New Books in South Asian Studies. I am your host, Ali Mohsen. Today we have with us Jason Keith Fernandez, who is the author of Citizenship in a Caste Polity, Religion, Language, and Belonging in Goa. The book came out a few months ago with Orient Black Swan in India. Currently, Jason Keith Fernandez is a researcher at the Center for Research and Anthropology at the University Institute of Lisbon. The book, Citizenship in a Caste Polity, Religion, Language, and Belonging in Goa, weaves together multiple disciplinary, conceptual, historical, and empirical threads to give us an insight into how citizenship and political subjectivities are constructed, negotiated, and experienced in Goa, especially when it comes to fixing and contesting identities around a language. Lucidly written and brilliantly argued, this book is a unique, critical, historical, and ethnographic account of the politics of Konkani language and will be valuable to scholars of history, political science, sociology, anthropology, citizenship studies, and cultural studies. And beyond that, also to the policymakers working on state and citizenship policies. Hello, Jason. Welcome to New Books Network.
Hi, Mohsin, and thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks a lot for writing this brilliant book, and also for engaging with us here at the New Books Network today.
It's my pleasure. I'm very flattered that you like the book.
So the first question here at New Books Network is usually biographical. Please tell us a little about your personal life story, especially like your personal and intellectual trajectory, especially in relations with the research that eventually became this book.
Right. So, biographically speaking, to just give you a sense of my intellectual trajectory, my first degree was a bachelor's in law. And this will become very, should be obvious when one reads the book. I did a degree in law. And because I was somewhat, problems with the way in which law was studying society, I kept looking, and I found eventually a master's in the sociology of law at the International Institute for the Sociology of Law in the Basque Country in Spain. So this was part of my shift eventually towards anthropology, which is what I did my doctoral work in. In fact, the book is a result of my doctoral work. So in that sense, I've moved from, one could say, pure law towards the anthropological study of law. So this would be my intellectual history. In terms of personal life, I grew up in Goa. Until I left Goa to enter the law school in Bangalore. And subsequently, I have moved from place to place, whether it's the Basque Country in Spain for the masters, or for the 10 years that I spent in, well, 10 and counting years that I've spent in Portugal, having first gone there to start my doctoral work. In terms of the way in which the my personal history has impacted on the book. I think the first impact would be in an appreciation of the liminal, or the appreciation of the liminal subject. Mm-hmm. I'm the product of a mixed marriage. So my father is Goan, and my mother, though she has Goan roots, belongs to a community known as the Mangalorians. So these are Catholics, Konkani-speaking Catholics, who migrated from Goa, from the Portuguese state of Goa, perhaps in the 17th century. I could get the century wrong, but so have been and moved into South Canara, where they established themselves. So growing up in Goa in the 80s, when we were in some ways still freshly integrated into India, was not easy. I think a number of, especially the groups that my father hailed from, were, I think, still insecure about their location in the new order. So Goan-ness was something that was very robustly defined and defended even. So belonging was could sometimes be difficult, because one came from this mixed marriage. And so I think this gave me a good, solid appreciation of people who would see themselves as Goan, but are not allowed to be defined as Goan. In fact, one of the terms that in Goa we use is the bailo, or the outsider. In English, this is the word that's used, the outsider. So who are they? Oh, they're outsiders. So this sense of the outsider is very, very strong in Goa. Surprisingly, it continues to be, it continues to have grown in strength, which I think also talks about the discomfort of Goa's integration into India. So anyway, this is the first bit of being liminal in Goan society. The second thing was already from a very young age, let's say from perhaps the late 80s, I was already aware that of the growth of Hindu nationalism in Goa, and the way in which Catholics were being pushed into a corner. Just as a personal anecdote, I had never thought that I would wind up an anthropologist. When I started out my higher education in law, this was the last thing I wanted to do. I actually wanted to be an archaeologist. The advice that I was given to dissuade me from becoming an archaeologist was, at that time, there was only one possibility to gain a livelihood as an archaeologist, and that was in the Archaeological Survey of India. And the advice was, listen, Baba, you are a Catholic and there are no options for us. You will be pushed into a corner and you will not be able to grow in your career. So rightly or wrongly, this was the advice given. And surprisingly, this is also the kind of rhetoric that I heard when I was doing my research, for what would eventually become this book. What is left for us here? Yeah, there are no options for us. It's better for us to leave and go. This is Goan Catholic speaking. So once again, this is personal history, the way in which it ties in with this book. And finally, ever since my master's, where I spent time in Spain, spent time in the Basque country, and saw the way in which the Basque country has troubles integrating with Spain, and the importance of legal histories to these kinds of difficulties, made me aware that it was important for me to be more attentive to Goan legal history and the reasons why Goa fits so problematically and difficult in such a difficult way into the Indian Republic. So what I wanted to do, what was very clear, was I wanted to craft a perspective that is honest about Goan legal history and the way in which it participates in India. So I would say that these are three different ways in which my personal life might integrate with the research that eventually became this book.
Thank you very much for that context. I think that's a good background to this book and also to our conversation today. So my next question will be, what do you think is the primary argument of the book, the conceptual thread that binds together the complexity of the arguments and the socio-historical analysis that it undertakes?
So, Mohsin, one of the things that has annoyed me ever since the book has come out is the fact that it is being seen as a book on Goa. Now, this is not surprising, because Goa is seen as this small place, peripheral to India, and therefore assumedly peripheral to South Asia and the study of South Asia. Maybe when I talk about the primary argument of the book, what I'd like to stress is that, yes, this may be a book about Goa, but Goa is merely the field. Yeah, Goa is merely the terrain through which I want to intervene in a much larger field of study. And that field of study would be citizenship theory. So this is really a work on citizenship, where Goa is the field. Secondly, this is a work on citizenship, but it is also more particularly an inquiry into the nature of citizenship in a purportedly secular liberal state, that is India, right? So at the end of the day, when I make this inquiry into the nature of the citizenship experience in this assumedly secular liberal state, what is the argument I'm making? The argument I'm making would be that one, India is not so much does not really operate as secular, and nor is it very much a liberal state, right? The argument I have really relied on in terms of a one column to around which I can structure the work is Partha Chatterjee's idea of political society, right? So he introduces this distinction between civil society, which he says is the realm of those who enjoy rights, and political society being the space of those who do not enjoy rights, who are citizens merely on paper or in theory, but don't in fact enjoy the rights of a citizen. All that they enjoy are concessions. So I distinguish my work from that, or I differ with Chatterjee, because based on some of the critiques that have been made of him that I support, you cannot have a civil society and a political society operating at the same time. You can either have civil society or you can have political society. And I would argue that what obtains in India is a political society, and more particularly, what obtains in India is a caste polity, right? And so the argument in India, the argument in this book is that the experience of citizenship in Goa, which is the space which I'm studying to understand India, is the experience of being in a caste polity, where if you are not dominant caste Hindu, you are you don't embody the ideal image of the citizen subject, right? So I think this would be the thread that runs through the book, and I'm sure we can elaborate on this as we go along. But But actually, no, let me just hold on. There is, so if one aspect of the work is citizenship, a second aspect would be, as I've already pointed out, trying to work away from the British Indian framework that is placed yeah. over so much of the work on South Asia and on Goa. So what I've tried to do in this work is to rewrite the histories of Konkani and Goans that are dominant. Histories of Konkani that are written. Konkani, of course, is the language spoken in Goa, the language through which around the politics of which I am seeking to talk about citizenship. So most of the histories of Konkani that obtain take British Indian frameworks as a given. So British Indian and therefore Indian nationalist frameworks as a given. And I'm trying to correct these narratives. And I should also point out that I've relied greatly on a couple of works, little more than a couple of works, that are already trying to do this, trying to get out of the frame of British India. The first book that I really should mention is that of Rochelle Pinto, which has this great title, Between Empires. I've relied also on the work of Raghu Thrissur, and also a more recent work by Parag Parabo, which looks at which was also published by Orient Black Swan, and talks about the politics under the first chief minister of Goa under Indian rule. So yeah, that would be, I think, the framework of the book.
So moving on from this, I was thinking of asking you about, like, in the book you briefly mentioned that you started off with a slightly different project in mind, but then gravitated towards exploring how the non-Hindus come to experience the citizenship in the Republic of India. With this in mind, I would like to ask you, what was the moment of discovery, so to speak, for you, when you realized that there was something here that was not being, given the careful attention that it deserved, but needed to be investigated?
I think I'm going to have to backtrack for a while now. So when I started out my doctoral work, my doctoral work was this really ambitious project that wanted to look at Goans in three spaces, Goa, Lisbon, and London, and try to see how they were engaging as citizens in these three spaces. And the point of departure was to be symbols of the Portuguese flag or the Portuguese state that at that time, let's say this is now in 2008, you would find on a number of bikes and cars, these little stickers, bumper stickers, which have the Portuguese flag or the Portuguese coat of arms. So my idea was to go and speak with people who own these vehicles and then figure out what were the statements they were making about themselves, about their legal identity, about the way in which they engaged with citizenship. The context over here is that when India annexed Goa in 1961, Goans were, in fact, citizens of Portugal, right? This is to distinguish them from, let's say, British Indians who were never citizens of the British state. They were merely subjects of the British crown. So already you see you're in a completely different framework. So India marches in, annexes Goa, gives Indian citizenship to Goans. But the Portuguese recognize, because of the nature of Indian takeover of Goa, the Portuguese recognize that Goans continue to hold Portuguese citizenship, which they continue to do. They only need to reinscribe themselves as citizens. So this is basically what what I realized was that perhaps the symbols of the Portuguese flags was a way to indicate that these were people who were reclaiming a Portuguese citizenship. And then I would trace backwards and go either to Portugal or to London, where these people would eventually go to work. Now, when I started approaching people, I realized that a number of these people, contrary to my initial expectations, a number of these people were not persons who came from what in Goa we call Portuguese-speaking background, right? These were persons who were from the working classes and castes and were making perhaps a new relationship with Portugal. And as I was trying to do this, I realized that there was no way for me to, there was no background literature on this group. As Raghu Trichur points out in his work, a lot of the work that is done on Goa, at least as he says, sociological and anthropological work, tends to try to support the nation-building narrative, right? So a lot of it tries to point out how Indian Goans are, or how Indian, that is to say, how Hindu, Catholicism in Goa is, right? So all of this is either an Indian perspective or a Brahmanical perspective, and conversations are largely with Catholic dominant castes who have a caste history through which they can integrate themselves into the Indian state. There's almost nothing on working caste Catholics. So I realized that I was floundering and I needed to... So I at this moment, as I was floundering, I was invited to be the chair to a debate that was happening in Goa. And this was about the Konkani language and the demand for the Roman script. And it was at this moment, as I was chair of this discussion, that I saw the whole field, as it were, unfold in front of me. From my perch up on by the speaker, I could see the various groups and the kind of politics that was playing out. And I realized that this was my entry point, that this was what was going to allow me to understand the dynamics in the field. And I really don't regret picking up that entry point, because I think it has allowed me to actually understand the way in which caste intersects with political identity in Goa. And I think this is a good base work from which to proceed, even if I say so myself. So this would be it. I think this is the job of the anthropologist at the end of the day. You go in with an idea, but you also allow the field to speak to you and to redirect you in another direction if necessary.
My next question is then about the historical context to the current politics of identity claims and contestations around the Konkani language, and about how Konkani came to define the Goan identity and the Goan claims to modernity. Mm-hmm. Particularly interesting here, I think, is the ways in which languages, castes, religions intersect when it comes to defining who might authentically be a Goan, and which language, dialect, or even a script is deemed to consolidate that identity.
So Mohsin, I think perhaps the best place to start would be to say that in 1987, the Konkani language was recognized through a legislation, the Official Language Act, as the official language of Goa, right? So the question, therefore, is how do we come to this point where Konkani is identified as the official language of Goa? The story begins already when Goa is a part of the Portuguese state. So we have this Portuguese civil servant who comes over from the metropole, that is from Portugal. And what he does when he comes to Goa is to emulate the best practices in terms of colonialism, romanticism, and orientalism, right? Which is to identify a language for the local. This has to be seen in the larger South Asian context. Now, I'd like to refer once again to Rochelle Pinto's book, and especially her phrase, Between Empires, where she says that Goa, even though it was formerly a Portuguese territory, its experience was living in the shadow of the British Empire, which was hegemonic. And the British Empire is the one that is setting the intellectual agendas, right? So in the in British India, you have the identification of various groups by languages. Based on this, you have these dominant castes across South Asia who then try to appropriate a language as theirs and try to define the language based on the way in which they're speaking. Now, this is being helped by Orientalists who, in any case, were working with largely with Brahmin groups and using Brahmanical language forms as the ideal language form of this particular language group, right? So something similar starts happening in Goa, which is you have this Portuguese administrator, Cunha Rivara, indicating what is that Konkani is the language of the people. This gets picked up by a group of local elites, and these are essentially the mixed race elites, what we call the descendants, right? The mixed race elites, or at least a small group among them, pick this up and try to promote Konkani as a language in Goa. This does not, however, get very much traction among the elites because, on the one hand, you have the Hindu elites who have embraced Marathi because Marathi is, well, they were struggling to get Marathi recognized as a language, and they had only then recently gotten Marathi recognized. Marathi also offered scope in terms, if you got state support for education in Marathi, you had greater opportunities within British India, within the Bombay presidency. So the Hindu elites are not interested in any way in Konkani. In fact, Konkani is seen as the language of the polluted Christian, right? So there's no way they might want to associate with Konkani. The Catholic elites, on the other hand, that is the Catholic native elites, are not interested in Konkani either because they identify with Portuguese. So Konkani really has no takers at this point of time, except for the working castes and classes who adopt Konkani both not only in their personal relations, but also to produce literature, whether this is novels or plays or even lyrics for music. So in the 1900s, if there is a group that is producing Konkani, it is this group of the laboring castes in Catholic, largely in Bombay, but also in Goa. These are people who have gained an education, have learned to write through the parochial schools, the parish schools that the church had set up. And so they write Konkani in the Roman script that they have learned. One should also recognize the role of the church in producing the Konkani language. At this point of time, I just want to point out that all too often, if I'm not mistaken, it was Dilip Menon who speaks about so much of work on South Asia as being dry because it does not recognize the operation of caste, right? So you cannot have a language in South Asia as you do in Europe, because each caste is speaking its own form of the language and is defending its form of the language, right? It will not share its language with the other caste. just as the Hindu elites in Goa wouldn't want to share Konkani with the Catholics, precisely because of the imputation of being polluted. So it is the Catholic Church, it is the missionaries who come to Goa already in the 16th century, who identify a language form, produce a grammar. Now, the production of a grammar is critical because it allows various groups to learn this grammar. It stabilizes the language form, right? And allows the production of a public sphere, which in those days would have been the paraliturgical Catholic sphere, right? So in the church is where you have this language being used and promoted. Catechisms are written in Konkani. So I would argue that Konkani, in the sense of a modern language that can be shared by various people, is a production of the Catholic Church. So this would be the kind of historical context. The problem emerges when Konkani is adopted by a Saraswat reformer, Varde Valavlikar, who is recognized today as the father of Konkani, of the Konkani language. This is a man who, to give him his credit, pushes really for the adoption of Konkani by the various jatis who today see themselves as Saraswat. But he is pushing this language for two reasons. One, to unite these various jatis into a single umbrella, which is the Gaud Saraswat Samaj, to give them a common identity, an identity that they can use to fight against the Marathi-speaking Brahmins who dominate in Bombay. So this would be the Konkanas Brahmins, the Chitpavan, who essentially reject these various jati who claim Saraswat status as being Brahmin. There are also other Brahmins in Karnataka who basically reject the Brahmin status of this group. So the idea is to produce a language that can unite them and will also be sufficiently Sanskritic, right? So the adoption of Konkani to give a corporate identity. And secondly, in the early 1900s is when these dominant castes across the peninsula are identifying languages and claiming linguistic spaces where they can dominate. So if the Maharashtrian Brahmins are claiming Maharashtra and there's no space for these Konkani-speaking jatis, they need to create their own space. And so you have Varde Valavlikar working within a larger framework, which is the attempt to create a space for Konkani-speaking Brahmins, right? So this is where the whole identification of Konkani as a Sanskritic language picks up, it gains force. And then Konkani begins to be the marker of Goan-ness, in a sense, once India takes over, once India annexes Goa. There was the fear of being merged into Maharashtra, into the state of Maharashtra. And so you needed to create your own regional identity, because this is also soon after the linguistic reorganization of states. So if you can claim that Konkani is our identity, you can stave off the claim of being integrated into Maharashtra. What is interesting about these attempts is that the literary works produced by these working caste and class Goan Catholics is used to buttress the claims in the Sahitya Academy. Laboring Goan Catholics are used to push the political mobilization, but the people who define what Konkani is are the Sanskritic lobby, and this is the Konkani that gets recognized. So essentially, what you have in 1987 then is this priest who is an activist for the Roman script argues, you have Pedro who does all the work, and Pandu who gets all the benefits. So the Catholic is completely excluded, because subsequent to the Language Act being passed, these groups now say that, well, the Roman script, Cockney written, the Roman script is not the official form, and therefore it cannot be recognized for any kind of state support. So you have a suffocation of the Cockney language as spoken and produced by Catholics. So I think this would be the context for the work that I studied.
So my next question is about your engagement with and your critique of Partha Chatterjee's work, right? Which, as you mentioned rightly, that it's at the heart of the book. It's an argumentative force and it's a conceptual field. And the book, I think, is a brilliant reflection on the notion of subalternity, especially in your dealing with Partha Chatterjee's distinction between civil and political society in the context of post-colonial democracies. For example, when you make a similar distinction between the politics that is articulated in terms of rights and the politics that finds articulation in strategies and maneuvers. And you also argue that such binary thinking might be useful in making sense of a lot of what you encounter in the intersecting politics of class, caste, language, dialect, script, and identity, and a whole range of these issues. But also, more importantly, you argue that in many ways, it falls short of grasping so much that goes into that complex politics. Would you please like to elaborate a bit on that?
Sure. I've already indicated that my problems and my critique of Chatterjee's work, which is essentially it's too economistic and it ignores caste entirely. But I think the problem with this formulation, as I studied it, is essentially that it falls into this modern trap of binaries, right? I think this is something that we need to get out of. I think it's great to be able to lay out a field and then say, okay, this is the way it works. But then we need to map out the way in which these various binaries combine and the way in which they operate in the social field. Which is why, along with Chatterjee's political civil society binary, I also adopted the categories formulated by this Portuguese social scientist, Boaventura de Sousa Santos, where he speaks about interlegality. So he identifies a range of six spaces which have their own legalities. And I thought that this was way more helpful in trying to understand the way in which the social field plays out, largely because you don't have the binary anymore, right? And also it worked to my understanding of what citizenship is, which is the creating a space for maneuver or creating a room for maneuver. And you create this room for maneuver at various levels. It could be within the family, within the community, within the marketplace. So what you have, therefore, in my understanding of citizenship, is not merely this relationship between the individual or community with the state, but this host of relationships that take place, in which the state is an important player, but and a dominant player, but not the only player, right? So everyone is trying to push and create space for themselves. So you have a much more complex web of social relations. So I think this helped supplement Chatterjee's idea and allowed me to analyze the field with some complexity and integrate in this way caste into my analysis. So this would be it. I think as social scientists, especially at a time when things are moving so fast, where change is so constant, I think we need to find ways in which our work can capture the dynamism of the social world rather than box them up neatly. Boxing is really great to start out and to get a conceptual idea of the field, but then we need to try and work with welding these various boxes together. And I hope, it's left for the reader to decide, but I hope I've done a good job of trying to weld these various groups together and show how it operates, how this complex network operates in practice.
But my next question is about the emotional and affective side of the citizenship experience, which I think is also one of the more important part of the work. So while most of the book deals with how the subaltern classes and castes of Goan Catholics experience and contest citizenship, the last chapter is a very insightful meditation on the emotional and affective side of political subjectivity among these groups. How are emotions such as shame and humiliation, as you suggest, experienced and articulated, and how do they play out in the larger politics of making claims vis-a-vis a peculiarly Goan identity?
So Mohsin, as I told you earlier, I started out on a completely different frame. And when I was doing my primary research, just getting a sense of the field, everyone was speaking about citizenship as practice, right? So being a good doctoral student said, well, I will also go and look at citizenship as practice. Once I got into the field, however, and because I wanted to and I had to take caste seriously, I realized that there was something else that was going on. It was not just practice. To put it in the terms of the work of Véronique Béni, who's run this really great work about citizenship and the body, the body is not merely a performing body. The body is also a feeling body, right? And this is the body that is present in politics. It's not some remote, abstract individual who doesn't feel but only thinks, right? It's the entire person that is involved in politics. And especially if you're going to deal with caste, and caste was so obvious. I'll just give you this anecdote. If you remember, I mentioned that I started out on this project after being the chair at a debate on the Konkani language and its politics. And in that session, there was this one individual who was so riled up by this Bahujan activist. He stood up and he said, essentially, "You monkey, are you teaching us the Vedas?" Because this activist had made a reference to the Vedas. I picked up on that instantly and I realized, oh my God, this is about caste as well, right? And from there on, I can't say it didn't unwind, but it was the seed on which I was able to collect this entire spool and create a ball. So this was one way in which, like, it was very clear that what we're speaking about is attempts at gaining dignity. As I was hanging out with these Catholic activists, Theatris are essentially persons who produce Konkani theater, the playwrights. What I realize is that it's also a demand for dignity. They're not merely looking to be integrated into the state. This is, of course, an essential part of what they want, support from the state for their work. But they're also looking for dignity. I had essentially Catholic Brahmin priests who were opposed to these working caste persons. These Catholic Brahmin priests were supporting the Nagari script, which is the officially recognized script for Konkani. whereas these Catholic activists were demanding the recognition of the Roman script. So these Catholic priests would say, what culture do they have, referring to the cultural and literary productions of these working caste persons. So it was about humiliation. And what was being attempted was to gain dignity and to gain respect. And this shaming would happen in very sophisticated ways, actually. For example, I remember this one individual telling me how he had gone for a job interview, an interview for a position in the Goa University. And he goes into the interview and the head of the panel says, Babu, let's take his name, Babu. He says, Babu, amka kite sang, which is in Konkani, says, Babu, why don't you tell us something? And this activist turns to me and he says, do you realize what was going on? And I was quite clueless. I said, no. And he says, what they wanted me to do was to speak to them in Konkani so that they could determine the form of Konkani I was speaking in. And this man is not a Brahmin, right? He comes from a Catholic working caste. Yeah. And this was the basis on which he was denied the position, at least in his estimation. And I see no reason why I should disbelieve him after having studied the field. Because the positions are given to persons who embody Brahmanical forms, right? This is something that I saw when I was working in the All India Radio. I used to operate as a radio jockey for the sins of all those who are listening to the radio. But this is where I realized that a certain form of Konkani was being pushed. It was a Konkani that is spoken by the Saraswats and then is adopted by... And then in the second grade came the form of Konkani spoken by by other Hindus, right? Non-Brahmin Hindus. And then, of course, the Konkani that is spoken by the Catholic working caste is essentially pushed away as much as possible. So these are ways of shaming, and I think it opens up a different sense of the body for us. It identifies the body's... Because language in this sense is embodied by the person who's speaking it. So if you are alienating or pushing away a certain kind of a language, you're also pushing away the bodies that embody that form. So really what you have is the operation of caste. These are various forms of untouchability, right? And I'm clear that untouchability has a very... a definite understanding, right? But I want to talk about this, picking up on Ambedkar, I want to also speak about if untouchability is this really harsh form, caste is also about, let's say, the diminishing degrees as you go further up the scale of this untouchability practices. So what you have operating as a result of the elevation of the Brahmanical form is various forms of untouchability in practice, various forms of caste discrimination in practice, right? So this is essentially shaming. An individual is not recognized as having human dignity, but is determined on their proximity or distance from the Brahmanical ideal. So this was the shaming that I experienced. The claims of humiliation is the way to... I follow. There is this great work edited by Gopal Guru in which Palshikar makes this very persuasive argument that humiliation is not something that happens, but humiliation is what happens when I turn around after being shamed. I turn around and say, this will not do. When I recognize that I'm being shamed and refuse to take it. So what we have in among the groups that I was studying and working with is our claims of humiliation and the assertion that this will not go on, right? So this was one way in which emotion came into the field because I was taking castes seriously. The other way in emotion comes in is when one refers, when following romantic models, one recognizes the language as a mother tongue. When one embodies the language as a mother, then one is a whole range of emotions of come into play based on how one treats one's mother, right? So we have to take care of our mother. We have to show obedience to her. We have a duty to her. And so if you don't speak your mother tongue, you're seen in some way as not respecting your mother. And there's a whole range of emotions that starts playing out. This is also something I picked up from Benny's work, which I would really encourage people to read. What I found really interesting, though, is that while in most places the language starts out as mother, and in South Asia it becomes the mother goddess even. So you have, if you look at Lisa Mitchell's work, which I also referred to, the Telugu language is cast as a goddess. In Karnataka, you have Kannada being placed as this goddess. In Goa, you don't have the same feature. She just remains the mother, but not, doesn't become a goddess. And I think this is largely because Konkani language activism relies on the energies and efforts of Catholics. And with Catholics, there's only so far you can do in terms of deification of an object. So this is why I think Konkani remains as a mother and not as a, doesn't transform into a mother goddess. So these were basically the ways in which emotion, I noticed emotion in the field. And I felt that if one is talking about citizenship anthropologically, one has to be attentive not merely to this working body, but also to the feeling body.
Yeah, this, I think, focus on the emotional and affective and bodily aspects of citizenship and political subjectivity, how they are experienced and articulated. This was truly like a refreshing thing to read for me as well, because as you also said, it's something that doesn't receive the kind of attention that it should receive, particularly in South Asian studies. So maybe then moving on from that, I believe this is a brilliantly argued book that brings together a lot of conceptual threads, as I already said, to illuminate the broader politics of citizenship, identity, and political subjectivity, not only in Goa and in South Asia, but also everywhere in multicultural societies. So then coming towards our conclusion, I would say, I would like to ask you actually that in the light of foregone discussion, if there is one idea that you think should stay with the listeners and the future readers of the book, what would it be?
Mohsin, I think what I would like readers to take away is to really challenge the kind of methodological nationalism that infects South Asian studies. But to a large extent, so many people take India as a given, right? And I just think that this is bad scholarship. If you refuse to see a world outside of India, right? I think this is a serious problem, and this needs to be checked. I mean, this is not some, especially in this day and age, I need to hasten to argue that it's not some kind of anti-nationalist argument, as much as an argument which could even benefit the polity, the Indian polity, because you shut so many doors when you refuse to get out of the methodological nationalism that structures your work. What we would be doing if we looked outside of the methodological nationalism would be to, in fact, open up opportunities for persons, whether in India or whether in South Asia. And I think this is something that I would really urge people to be attentive to, is to just, I mean, and this is by being part of my effort, I can look at India from a Goan perspective, only because I'm refusing to accept the methodological nationalism that has structured work on Goa thus far. So I think this is something that I would urge readers to be, or listeners to be attentive to.
So at the end, I would like to ask you, mm-hmm. what are your current research interests and projects? What should we look out for in the next years? What's in the pipeline?
One, right now, I'm translating the biography of a Portuguese, a Konkani novelist, Bonaventure de Pietro. This biography is really gold. And I think, once again, is the voice, in some sense, the unmediated voice of the working caste Goan Catholic. When I finished my work, I felt at the end of the day, while I was attentive to caste, I was honest to what my collaborators were saying, this was still the work of a dominant caste Catholic, right? And therefore, it was just like a dominant caste voice mediating their voices. This novel, I believe, really presents the voice of the Catholic working caste person. And I hope to finish it by the middle of next year. So that's one work that I'm working on. More generally, after this doctoral work, I was interested in the way in which the Catholic Church in India deals with Indian nationalism. And I think this is increasingly a problem that we need to engage with, especially because of the increasing militancy of Indian or Hindu nationalism against non-Hindu groups. In fact, this is one of the things I just like to point out that I thought was useful about my work, is that it breaks up this Hindu-Muslim binary through which we study Indian secularism. Because if the Muslim is the other to the Hindu self, then any obsession with the Muslim, as happens with secularism in India, and this is to not take away from the trials of Muslims in India, I'm completely sympathetic, but if you are obsessed with the Indian Muslim to the exclusion of other groups, then really what the debate is a debate about the Hindu self. Once again, the debate on secularism is a discourse on the Hindu self, which is why we need to focus on these non-Muslim, non-Hindu minoritized groups in India. So this work on the Catholic Church and the way in which it's engaging with nationalism is something that I've been working on as well. Finally, pushing this language of against methodological nationalism further, I've really been looking at empire and the way in which imperial languages actually offer space to groups that have currently been marginalized and imprisoned within the nation state. It is very, very fashionable to use empire as shorthand for everything that is evil. But these are historically very narrow understandings of empire that draw largely on the British understanding of empire, on late modern colonial empires, and this is really does not exhaust the understanding of empire. So the language of empire, of the imperial scale, definitely offers groups that have currently been marginalized space, or as I would say, room to maneuver. And this is something that I'm working on. So yeah.
That sounds really fascinating and promising, and I really look forward to reading more of your work.
Thank you, Mohsin.
Thanks a lot, Jason, for engaging with us today. And also many thanks to all the listeners out there. Till next time, bye-bye.
Bye-bye, and thank you for your patience.